On Monday, the 15th of January this year, the Prime Minister of the State of Israel, in the course of a visit to a number of capitals on the continent, paid a call on the reigning Pope in his palace in the Vatican. At the end of that Monday morning visit, a brief three-paragraph communique was issued, which read, "His Holiness, after having reviewed the history and the sufferings of the Jewish people, presented the Holy See's point of view on the problems which have to a large extent relevance to its humanitarian mission, such as the refugee problem, and the situation of the various communities which live in the Holy Land, and those problems which are directly related to its more specific religious mission concerning the holy places, the sacred and universal character of the city of Jerusalem." The Prime Minister emphasized Israel's desire for peace and amply described the position and the possibilities of reaching a peaceful solution in the Middle Eastern conflict through negotiations between the parties and on the above-mentioned subjects, and also referred to the phenomenon of terrorism, as well as the special conditions concerning Jewish communities in certain parts of the world. His Holiness, finally, expressing his warmest wishes that justice and law would establish peace and coexistence among all the peoples of the Middle East, once again declared the intention of the Holy See to do all within its possibilities in order to reach these goals. In other words, the Pope had spoken to Mrs. Meir about the refugee problem, about the needs of the various Roman Catholic communities in Israel, about the special concern that the Vatican has for the Christian holy places which are under the Israeli flag. The Prime Minister had spoken to Paul VI about the possibilities of direct negotiations as a prelude to peace in the Middle East. He'd spoken about a possible Catholic role in various Arab countries where the Roman Catholic Church has missions, which might help in the succor of endangered and often imprisoned Jewish communities. And finally, about the very difficult problem, terrorism. Now, the question which surfaces is this: why had this meeting taken place in the first instance? Obviously, both Mrs. Meir and Pope Paul are well aware through their envoys and through their reading of the condition and the attitudes of their respective governments towards the various problems in the Middle East. It would seem that Israel had hoped that this meeting would gain the appearance of a symbolic de facto recognition of the state. It seems incredible, but it is true, that 25 years after the establishment of the State of Israel, the Roman Catholic Church, through the Vatican, alone among the major nations of Europe, has not seen fit to acknowledge officially the existence of the Jewish state. And it was deemed that the time might be appropriate for such a meeting, and that this meeting would make it seem as if the de facto recognition had in fact come into being. On its hand, the Vatican was obviously concerned with the upcoming negotiations with Israel over the extraterritorial status of the various holy sites. Ever since the June War of 1967, the church has, for better or for worse from its point of view, found itself in a position where it must negotiate with Israel, whether Israel exists or not. All of the great sites in Nazareth and Jerusalem and Bethlehem and elsewhere in Israel, sites which have been in Christian hands more or less for the last few hundred years, sacred sites to the Roman Catholic Church, are now under Israeli sovereignty. And the Israelis have been scrupulous in allowing the church, the various churches, Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Coptic, and the like, control, absolute control of these sites. And they have offered to the Roman Catholic Church a form of extraterritorial control of these sites, very much the way foreign countries have extraterritorial control of their embassies in other lands. These negotiations are going on. Now, whatever was in the mind of the Israelis, the day was not to be simply what they hoped it would be. For immediately upon the removal of Mrs. Meir and her entourage from the Vatican, when their well-guarded limousine had driven away from St. Peter's Square, one of the lay officials of the Vatican's Secretariat of Communications, Dr. Federico Alessandrini, called a press conference. And at that press conference, he announced that Israel had, in a sense, forced this meeting upon the Vatican, that the Pope had agreed to it only because of his Christian charity, out of humanitarian concern for the dispossessed and powerless peoples of the world, especially out of his concern for the Palestinian refugees. Alessandrini went on to say that the Pope met with many groups. His meeting showed no preference or no encouragement. He had met with King Hussein of Jordan, with other important Arab leaders, and that the Pope had taken occasion of this meeting with Mrs. Meir to reaffirm the now nearly three decades old Catholic policy of insisting that Jerusalem, Israel's capital, must not be Israel's capital, but must instead be what the Church calls a corpus separatum, a separate enclave, ruled internationally by a government in which the Roman Catholic Church would have a major say. Now, Mrs. Meir was then forced to hold a press conference of her own in Rome. And the obvious first question was asked her, wasn't this in fact a diplomatic slap in the face? And she answered in her simple, direct way, well, she hadn't barged into the Vatican. She'd been asked. And she accepted the fact that the official communique was the only official communique of the conference. And she agreed with the Pope when he had said to her that he felt that this meeting was of historic consequence. The next morning, the Pope sent to Mrs. Meir a few gifts, a white dove of peace, a beautifully printed Bible. But there was no renunciation by the Vatican of Dr. Alessandrini's comments, and the whole issue was allowed to lay exactly as it lay. How is it that in this enlightened year of 1973, 25 years after the proclamation of the State of Israel, 10 years after Pope John called Vatican II the Great Council of Renewal, whose major purpose besides Christian renewal was to develop a new posture, a post-medieval posture for the Roman Catholic Church vis-a-vis all other religious communities in the world, how is it that at this moment in time the Roman Catholic Church cannot bring itself to say a few very simple factual phrases? Israel exists. We don't have to like it. We don't have to agree with everything the State of Israel does. But it's a state, just like France, just like Germany, just like Egypt, just like Jordan, just like Lebanon, with all of whom we have official and correct diplomatic relationships. And we will go on from there. What sticks in their craw about the existence of this Jewish state? Apologetes for the Vatican policy, the spokesmen of the official church, have always tried to explain the church's position on the basis of the church's humanitarian or moral or religious mission. The first argument that one hears is that the church has a particular concern for the security of the 3 million Catholics who live in the great Arab Sea, in the Arab world. That were the church to have diplomatic relationships with Israel, their security would somehow be endangered. Put less kindly, this is simply the statement that the church is the largest corporation in the world, which has found it prudent to give in to the Arab boycott. The church has relationships with many countries in which there are Catholic minorities or Catholic majorities who have unfortunate attitudes towards other countries in which there are Catholic minorities. The second argument of the church fathers is this: that the church has a particular concern for the defenseless, the landless, the abused, and that until Israel, in a sense, makes good its responsibilities to the Arab refugees, how can a Christian state, a Christian community, recognize its existence? Very moral, very high-sounding, very pristine. But unfortunately, the church has relationships with Jordan and with Lebanon, which have kept the Arab refugees for 25 years in Arab-dominated camps because they are convenient political ploys and has found no difficulty in having these relationships. And the church finds it possible to have diplomatic relationships with Eastern Bloc nations and with the Soviet Union, which have, over the last 25 years since the Second World War, imprisoned large numbers of Roman Catholics. Forget the Arab Muslims, but of Roman Catholics in Soviet and Eastern Bloc work camps and abused them unmercifully. The third argument of the church has to do with its prescriptive and presumptive rights in Jerusalem. That somehow it has a right to governance in what is the capital of the state of Israel. Now, one cannot argue with this assertion. One can simply say that there are no such presumptive rights written into international law, that the state of Israel has guaranteed and made good on the guarantee of open access to all shrines by all pilgrims, that it has promised the various orders which control these shrines that they may have free access to them, complete control over them, control their refurbishments, their dominance. Indeed, that the only problems that Israel has had with the shrines have been when three competing Christian sects begin to battle during one another of the holy seasons over who's to light which light when. Nor I'm afraid that the problem that the Roman Catholic Church has with the existence of the State of Israel does not come over the fact that Israel has not qualified itself as a state equal to all other states in justice and morality, but rather from the fact that the church is imprisoned still by its own medieval theology and by some very ancient prejudices, and that it sticks in the craw of the church to admit that the despised people, for whom any number of popes announced bulls, edicts, that they must live in ghettos and wear Jew badges and a particular kind of funny hat to signify that they were less than human, this strange, despised people somehow has risen like the phoenix from the ashes and has come into its own. It's a living reality, a creative reality, national reality in this century. The church attitude towards the Jewish state is judgmental. And there is no blindness so deep as that of self-righteousness. Mrs. Meir, when she returned to Israel, reported on her visit with the Pope in an interview with Maariv. I suspect she would not have done so had not the whole Alessandrini affair forced her hand. But in any case, it appears that the Pope, in his opening statement to her, said the following. She's quoting here. The Pope said to me at the outset that he found it hard to understand how the Jewish people, who should be so merciful, behave so fiercely in its own land. And she was reminded of the fact, she said, at that moment that here His Holiness was sitting under the cross, a beloved symbol to Christians throughout the world, but to Jews, a symbol of religious, state religious powers which had destroyed, killed, martyred millions of Jews over the centuries. What are the problems of the church with the existence of a Jewish state? Let me cite you a bit of history, because history offers us a perspective which the headlines do not. In 1904, when Theodor Herzl was moving heaven and earth to bring the Zionist movement into being, he visited with the ministries and the leaders of most of the nations of Europe in order to encourage them with his vision, to solicit support for his program, which was simply this. There's an empty or almost empty piece of land, a stretch of wilderness in the Middle East in a place called Palestine, which is relatively unpopulated. There are less than 100,000 people there. Nobody really seems to want it. There's an insoluble Jewish problem in Europe because of the inheritance of European of Christian anti-Semitism. Let my people go and establish their own land and be an equal nation among equals. And he visited London, he visited in Paris, he visited in Vienna, Istanbul, and at one point he went to visit the Pope. And he tried to present his case to the Pope. The Pope's name was Pius X, and he was very abruptly and curtly brought to a close in his opening statement, and the Pope said this to him, and this only. We cannot favor the movement. The Jews did not recognize Jesus our Lord, and we therefore cannot recognize the Jewish people. If you come to Palestine and settle your people there, we will be ready with priests and churches to baptize all of you. We were, according to Roman Catholic theology, in biblical times, God's chosen people. It was with Moses and the children of Israel, and before him with Abraham and his descendants, that God made his covenant with mankind. But then when God, for reasons best known to him, determined to send the Messiah and the new covenant, we proved blind. We denied the Messiah, God's son, God's chosen messenger. We denied that there was a new covenant, a new dispensation. We were blind. And for our obstinacy, God determined to punish us. And then we compounded blindness with murder. We were involved in the crucifixion, in the death of the Christ. And somehow all Jews bear a taint on their souls, the taint of deicide, for which God cursed them and declared them accursed. And within a generation, he drove them out of their land and destroyed their temple. Exile is seen as proof of our accursed status. And we were to be, because God willed us to be, perpetual wanderers across the face of the earth, outcasts, pariahs. And those who abused us and those who sought to us that we remained servile and apart, they were simply fulfilling the will of God. For we had abandoned our claim to equality among mankind. And we would not be returned to our land or to our status as men until we accepted the new dispensation and acknowledged the Christ, and then alone would God forgive us. This was church doctrine. This was church teaching century after century after century. We were the old covenant people. They were the new Israel. We had abandoned our claims of a special relationship with God or any relationship with God except that of being accursed. And to dream of renewal, to dream of a return to our land was on our part an act of utter arrogance. We were violating by doing so the will of God. And more than this, we were declaring that somehow God's whole mission as understood by the church was false. There was only one true church according to the church, only one blessed people. We were somehow debased, demeaned. We shouldn't have the power, the strength, the ability after 19 centuries of exile to renew ourselves, yet here we were trying to do so. And during the long decades of the 20th century, as the pioneers came and made Aliyah to Israel, to Palestine, the church was unsympathetic to the movement. The various church orders that existed in the Holy Land did very little except occasionally to try to convert Jews to the true light. They were aloof and they were distant at best. Not once in the 1930s did the Vatican raise its voice and ask Great Britain and the West to allow more Jews into the Holy Land to help them to escape from the Holocaust. And then when the issue of Palestine became an issue before the United Nations, when England abandoned the mandate, the Vatican's major position was not to encourage a Jewish state, but rather to demand that if partition were voted, that partition scheme must include a provision which would cut out Jerusalem and Bethlehem, the most sacred of the areas to the Christians, from any Arab or Jewish state, and declare it to be this separate international entity. On May 14th, 1948, once Israel had declared its independence and the proclamation of independence had been read, Osservatore Romano, the official paper of the Vatican, came out with an editorial which began, "Modern Zionism is not the true heir of biblical Israel. It is a secular state, and for that reason the Holy Land and its sacred places belong to Christendom, the true Israel." During the early years of the state, when the Vatican or the Roman Catholic hierarchy had to have some dealings with Israel because of its control of areas such as Bethlehem, such as Nazareth, the letter would be addressed to whom it may concern, Tel Aviv. Of pettiness and meanness, one really can't improve. Now, Israel forced all kinds of theological, folkloristic, psychological renewal upon the church. Churchmen had been accustomed to look upon the Jew as a suppliant. We were the minority, they were part of the imperial majority. We were the outcasts, they were those who belonged to the centers of power. Every year in Rome, the ancient Jewish community had on one of the great days of papal procession to appear at a certain point along the road out of a back alley, carrying with them the scrolls of the Torah from the Ark, and to present this Torah scroll along with a good bit of money to the Pope and to say to him, "We, your humble servants, we beseech you for Christian mercy. and the Pope would take the Torah, pocket the money, but return the Torah and say to the Jews, we return to you your accursed teaching, go in peace. It's hard for those who have for a long time dominated the world to accept the fact that those from the shadows, from the underworld, can somehow emerge. And worse than this, that you must have relationships in which you're asking them for favors. You want certain things of them. And there was also, of course, a new spirit abroad in parts of the church, as there was a new spirit abroad throughout the world. A spirit which said this is the arrogance of old-time religions, particularly of the authoritarian religions, that they alone had the light, they alone had the vision, they alone were the truth. That such assumptions were out of order in this small one world. And it was in that spirit that Pope John the 23rd convened the Second Vatican Council. And it was in that spirit that many came to the Vatican Council in the hope that a new, more honest, more equal relationship might be developed by the church towards other communities in the world. I don't know if you remember the years of debate by the Vatican Council from 1962 to 1965 over the issue of how they should deal with the Jewish protocol. No issue was stuck more in the throat of the council elders than this one. And finally, they brought out a statement which said, in effect, not all Jews in Christ's generation were guilty of deicide, and certainly not all Jews since. The Jews were once the beloved people of God. We are now that people, but the Jews continue to have, as do all people, some kind of relationship to God, and we must learn to understand and appreciate those values. In the middle of the Vatican Council, the Pope died. And the new Pope, the present Pope, at the end of the second session, determined to make a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. The Holy Land is, by the way, a Christian euphemism which allows them not to say Israel. It allows them not to admit the fact that Israel is. Holy Land sounds nice and biblical and romantic and religious, but actually it's almost an anti-Semitic kind of word today. The Pope decided to make a visit to the Holy Land. He would never spend a night in Israel. He flew to Amman, and he met there with the various Eastern Orthodox clergymen and his own Roman Catholic people in the area. It was to be primarily a moment of reconciliation between the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. But one day he determined he would make a sweep through Israel, and he entered up near in the Galilee near Nazareth, and he went from Nazareth to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem. Never once during this whole trip did Pope Paul refer to the state of Israel. He always said, ce territoire, this territory. Now, a number of his cardinals he sent on this or that mission of reconciliation, but he himself remained aloof. And when he came, it came to the moment of parting from that day before the Mandelbaum Gate, he said nothing about the pioneering work of Israel, nothing about the renewal of these people who just a generation before had been the survivors of the worst Holocaust man had ever inflicted upon man. He took this occasion to condemn a play written by a Lutheran, a German, called The Deputy, in which this German Lutheran had had the chutzpah to condemn his predecessor, by Pope Pius, for collusion in the Nazi conspiracy. No one in the state of Israel had written The Deputy. The Deputy had even been played in the state of Israel. But this Pope, symbol of the Roman Catholic Church, which bore a good bit of guilt over the centuries and in our century for anti-Semitism, for the Holocaust, could find nothing more in his heart to speak about at that moment than the fact that in his eyes, one of his predecessors had been maligned by somebody out in Europe. And there you have, really, in essence, the problem of the church vis-a-vis the state of Israel. By all the tenets in which so many of these men have been raised and the environment which has conditioned them, Israel should not be. We bear the judgment of God. We didn't see the light by which they live. We refuse even now to acknowledge it. We were accursed. And yet here we are, blessing a land with our effort, raising great cities, able to take care of ourselves, not having to bend the knee and to accept the condescension, the patronage, the Christian charity of anyone else. Now, after 1967, the relationships of the church and the state of Israel became somewhat more correct. There were forces which, for modernity, for fraternity, which had been unleashed by the Vatican Council. One saw it often in the local community, though not in this community. But the church itself, for reasons of prudence, not for reasons of charity or humanity, had good reason now to begin to develop a more correct stance vis-a-vis Israel. For Israel, which had been simply a state which they could largely fail to acknowledge, was now a state which controlled the major shrines of, quote, the Holy Land, unquote. All Christian building, all the sects, all the hospices, all of the museums, all of the schools, all of the shrines of Catholicism within Israel were under the Israeli flag. There had to be relationships. Before 1967, before the victory of 67, the church could remain silent about the survival of the State of Israel. In May of 1967, the Pope said only three things. He prayed for peace, he counseled everyone to go to the United Nations, and he spoke of the refugees. Not a word about the rights of Israel to sovereignty, to survival. But after 1967, prudence reigned in the Vatican, and the papal nuncio, who had lived in the Holy Land, that is, in East Jerusalem since 1948, who had fled to Amman in April of 1948, in 1967, was replaced by a man whose orders were obviously to mix, to mingle, to get to know a few Jews, to learn to deal openly with the various secretariats of the Israeli government. And there began a series of negotiations with the Israeli government, which I think surprised the Vatican. For Israel bent over backwards to make it easy for the various Catholic communities to maintain their activities and regain control of their shrines. Now, during the entire period of Jordanian occupation of Jerusalem and of the West Bank, the church had not raised a single murmur about the fact that Jews couldn't get to the synagogues in East Jerusalem, or about the fact that Jordanians did not permit the Christians of Israel always to cross over to Bethlehem or to the other great sanctuaries in Jerusalem. But now there was a hue and cry. Israel will not allow Arab Christians to come to Nazareth or to come to Bethlehem or come to the Holy Sepulchre. And these, of course, proved false. Israel had the policy of open borders. Anyone could come, Muslim, Christian, anyone. And the Israelis went further. There was a group in Israel called the Assumptionist Fathers. The Assumptionist Fathers had a great center in Jerusalem, but their numbers had dwindled, and they determined to sell the building for reasons best known to them. And they sold the building to the Jewish National Fund, which in turn sold the building to the Hebrew University, which wanted the area for expansion. The Roman Catholic Church has a position that no building, no shrine, which is dedicated to Christ ought to revert to secular to use. And a great cry came up from the Vatican that pressure had been brought on these Assumptionist fathers to sell. Nothing could have been further from the truth. But the Israelis went back on the fundamental law of the Jewish National Fund, which is that the land that they own is to remain in perpetuity in ownership for the Jewish people. And they sold back this area to the Roman Catholic Church for whatever reasons they proposed to use it. Again and again and again, the Israelis maintained the most correct and then some relationships with the Roman Catholic Church. And Monsignor Lagi, the new nuncio, began to mix in Jerusalem diplomatic circles. He never entered into religious conversations as such and in terms of dialogue, but for the first time there was a Roman Catholic face one could know, who talked to one rather openly. When I was in Jerusalem in April of last year with some of the church leaders of Cleveland, we spent an hour or two with Monsignor Lagi. He's a very correct and proper Italian diplomat. He knows exactly what he will say and what he will not say, but that's the role of a diplomat. But in terms of the church's relationship to Israel, he is symbolic, not of openness, but at least of a beginning of a correct diplomatic procedure. And that's really where events were preceding Mrs. Meir's visit in January of this year. The Israelis hoped that there had been enough correct relationship, cool distance, in order to move one step further and have some kind of open acknowledgement by the Vatican of Israel's existence and some kind of more open, more easy relationship between the two communities. How do we read what happened in a month ago? There's very little that we Jews can do to change, to speed up the change, if change it be, within the church. Its problems in relationship to the existence of a vital, modern, effective Jewish community are its problems. They're not ours. We are. That's all we can be. There are within the church, churchmen high and low, who understand the reasons for the existence of a state of Israel, who are not prisoners of ancient prejudice or medieval theology, and who have openly and with great understanding made clear their feelings. And there are churchmen within the state. We had an example within the Roman Catholic Church. We had an example of it in Cleveland just this last week, when Cardinal Kroll of Philadelphia came in for a non-political meeting with the Maronites and with the Lebanese Catholic community of Cleveland, and used the occasion to berate the newspapers for their biased prejudice of Middle Eastern affairs and to suggest the belligerency and the unacceptable activism of the Israelis. What will happen? What will the future bring? I don't know. It's a question of how far the spiritual renewal of the Roman Catholic Church will take it. If the church continues to see itself as the ultimate font of wisdom, truth, and judgment, to be self-righteous in all of its dealings, there can be no dialogue. Israel will remain very difficult for the church to deal with. But Israel is quite conscious of the millions of Roman Catholics throughout the world, the Pope's legions, wants very much to open up this last reservoir of medievalism, is doing all that it can within the area of diplomatic maneuvering to make it possible. It's not welcome for any of us to be reminded that in this enlightened year of 1973, there are these very clear evidences of continuing medieval thinking among our so-called fellow citizens. We don't like to think of the fact that religious communities tend to use words, great, beautiful words, to mask petty and prejudiced deeds. These are the facts. But it must also be said that within the church there is a spirit of renewal. The present pope seems to have dampened it down a good bit, but it was let loose. The genie was out of the box. It's hard to see how over the long term it may not ultimately surface and perhaps even gain control of the Roman Catholic hierarchy. I read to you this morning from our Torah the law which says that we are to take pure olive oil beaten for the light, and with it to light an eternal light. The rabbi suggested that the light is Israel. That Israel is, you know, pure olive oil beaten, mollified. It used to take the olive and beat it, pound it, to get out the oil, and the more they pound it, the more and purified it, the brighter the flame. The centuries have pounded us. We have been beaten and we have been bruised, and somehow out of that has come whatever qualities of and virtues we possess. And it is these qualities which have allowed us to witness to God and to the Torah which he has revealed to us. We're used to being maligned. We can take it. But I would wish and hope that others of other persuasions would learn that we indeed have but one Father, that indeed only one God has created us all, that these old superstitions and prejudices and hates have no place in this century. For God knows, faced as we are with the real problems of war and poverty and racial prejudice, the great religions of the West have little leisure and leeway to be fighting old fights, fights which go back to the days of the Crusades, the days of the crucifixion, and have nothing to do with the 20th century.